the Triathlon Show 342. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Rito Brändli. Rito is a Swiss triathlon and cycling coach working with professional and amateur athletes. He also runs the Performance Lab Training and Diagnostics, and we will talk a lot about the different tests that he uses with his athletes and how he recommends applying test results in training and so on. But we will also talk a lot about his general coaching and training philosophy, if you want to call it that. We'll get right into the interview after thanking our sponsors. First, we have Precision Fuel and Hydration that create hydration and nutrition products for endurance sports. Big news today, as the 13th of June, which is the release date of this episode, is also the launch date of the new PF30 caffeine gel, which contains 30 grams of carbohydrate and 100 milligrams of caffeine, which is a big difference compared to most caffeine gels on the market that contain significantly less caffeine than that. But Precision Fuel and Hydration have designed a gel so that one dose can actually make a difference, although of course you might be using two or more caffeine gels depending on things like race distance, your tolerance to caffeine and more. But generally speaking, you want to be aiming for 3 to 6 milligrams per kilogram body weight to see the performance benefits of caffeine. And that becomes a lot easier when you have a decent amount of caffeine in one gel. There will be a lot of content about caffeine dropping on their website today and over the next few days. So if you want to learn more about the science of caffeine and endurance performance, check that out. And if you want to get 15% off your first order of electrolyte and energy products, use the promo code TTS22 at checkout on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Zen8. The Zen8 Indoor Swim Trainer is a swim training tool that you can use at home that allows you to improve your technique, work on power and stamina, and save time and stay consistent. Consistency is one of the key things of the Zen8 Swim Trainer, because sometimes you just don't have time to commute to the pool, get changed before and after, and commute back. It's just good to have that time-efficient way that you can use as a complement to your pool or open water swimming, which you can do at home in very little time. In addition, the Zen8 Swim Trainer allows you to do things like swim, bike, brick workouts, and you can also work on technical aspects, including core activation and streamline, with the help of the built-in instability element of the swim bench. It does not take up a lot of space, and it is very affordable, and even more so with a 20% discount code that you can get on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. It is also a risk-free investment. If you don't love it after 2 weeks of using it, send it back and you can get a full refund. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Rito Brändli. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Rito. How are you doing?
Hey, hi, Michael. How are you doing? Thank you so much for having me today.
It's my pleasure. Let's start with an introduction. Can you tell the audience who you are and what your background is in endurance sports?
Yeah, sure. My name is Rito Brändli. I live at the Lake of Zurich. I do have twins at the age of 4, so a girl and a boy. And I do work for Training and Diagnostics. This is a performance testing center in Zurich, Switzerland. So at Training Diagnostics, we do performance tests for athletes from the field of triathlon, such as example, Florian Ongert or Jan van Berkel. But we also have a lot of soccer, ice hockey players, track and field athletes, cyclists, mountain bikers, and so on. But of course, the main target group, we have a lot of just normal people who want to have data for their daily workouts. And since we have a DEXA scanner, we do have a lot of clients who are just interested in having body composition data. And beside that, we do offer some special training methods, such as blood flow restriction, as an example. And if I remember right, I think you had this as a topic on your show, right, in the past.
Yeah, a couple of times, a couple of interviews on that topic.
Cool, yeah. Cool. So... last but not least, we do coaching mainly for triathletes and cyclists, which I am, beside of some other things. If you're running a small company, I'm responsible for. Briefly about myself, my first contact with sports was within cycling at the age of I was roughly 13 years, and I went all the way up from being a junior to an elite rider, which 1 year at the pro level. But unfortunately, I was not very successful, to be honest, at pro level. So normally when the TV cameras went on, I was on my way in the group vector. The group vector is always the last group in the race. And since this was not good fun, I decided then to go back to study and work. But even after leaving the world of elite sport, it was still for me very close to it because my sister, she was also a pro cyclist, but she was far more successful than I was. She's a three times Giro d'Italia, so Tour of Italy winner. She was second at Tour de France, Swiss road champion, TT champion, three-time Olympian, and so on. My brother-in-law is working for a UCI World Pro Cycling Team as a sport director, and my girlfriend back then, now she's my wife, she was a pro athlete racing for the German Erdinger team, and she retired 2015. She won, I think, two Ironmans and several 70.3 races, and if I'm not completely wrong, she's still under the top three fastest Swiss long-distance female athletes. So you see, I could really not escape the world of high-performance sports then. I've then met, more or less by coincidence, Olivier Bernhardt. So a younger generation know him probably as one of the founder of the On Running Shoes. But back then, in the days when duathlon, especially the world championships in Zofingen, were really big, he won them three times, and he was a five-time Ironman Switzerland champion. So back then, he has just finished his career and was in progress to build up his own company and coaching company, and he was asking me to join. And this, of course, was a great opportunity for me to learn from one of the best in our region. And by then, he was coaching and advising all the young Swiss triathlon stars such as Ronny Schildknecht and Rudi Wild, Matthias Hecht. So I could really learn them out of first hand. And then his work with On Running Shoes went bigger and bigger, so he decided to focus only on the running shoe business. So I moved on and joined the young company Training Diagnostics back then, which was a spin-off of the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. And so here we are.
Yeah. And just to set the context of, especially in particular, your coaching, you coach a few pro athletes. You coach a pro and age group athletes, but a few pros that I'm sure the listeners have heard of. So can you tell us who you're working with at the moment?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I do coach about 10 age group athletes. And within the pros, there are two female from the HEP. German team. One is Anne Reichmann and the other one is Imogen Simmons. Then I do have a junior national athlete, so we're working there very close with the Swiss national team together. A male pro, Fabian Dutli. He came all the way up from being an age grouper. Now he's a very solid 70.3 racer, and he's doing his first Ironman this year. And in a couple of weeks, Swedish athlete Rasmus Svenningsson will join our squad here.
Oh, that's exciting. Rasmus is a good friend of mine.
Oh, okay. Well, excellent.
I'm sure he will listen to this as well.
I hope so.
Yeah. So let's start with the first question, which is probably the most difficult one, which is how would you describe your coaching and your approach to triathlon training?
Mm-hmm. Maybe we can split that a little bit into pro and age groupers, if this is okay for you. So pros are very much data and process orientated, but I would say with the target to develop the athlete and so support him to learn to listen to the signals of his body and take over also responsibility. And of course, this depends where the athlete is in his career with his physiology, but also how his post looks like, saying that meaning the age he's in, sport background, years within triathlon on top level, and of course how his training was built up to this level. So with the pros, then I'll try to to find the right amount of training that is close to the limit, since we're talking about pro sports, of course, but also considering how much of the training or the impact is really necessary to reach the performance buildup. So I do look for maximal adaptation possible per cyclus or per phase, which we will maybe later talk a little bit, but it's, I think it's not always about just train as much as possible or as hard as possible. Just to be very specific, or try to be very specific. And since we work with different systems, such as cardiovascular, muscular, neuronal system, we have to find the limit factor of the athletes and what is really important for him to do the next steps within cardiovascular or muscular systems. This is how I would describe the approach for pros and for the age grouper. I mean, the focus there is on what is really important. So I try to keep things as simple as possible. Also learn them to listen to the signals of their body and just to do smart decisions. So I do take the workload from job, from family life and other requests very seriously. So, and we have to find a smart way to combine it. And also, I mean, for the age group, but also for the pros, it's so important just to stay healthy and have fun by what they're doing. Yeah, consistency is important for them, of course. And talking about consistency, sometimes I do cut or shorten sessions in the short term just to make sure they can stay consistent in the long term. And really try to avoid the big yo-yo effect.
That makes a lot of sense. A couple of follow-up questions then. Firstly, on the pro side, when you mentioned that, you are looking for kind of the maximum, trying to find the maximum amount of or the maximum stimulus for the pros. What are your methods for doing that, but without going too far? What are the things that you're looking at to find that maximum?
Mm-hmm. I mean, relationship getting better and better as more time we can spend together, or the more seasons we work together. As I mentioned that at the start, we have a lot of data, so we're looking at it, and then it's about the feedback about the session. And yeah, then creating this metric of see how they react on the training, how their feedback is, how their data change. And then starting from this point on, just to building it up, to adapt it maybe a little bit on the left, on the right-hand side, and then just go step by step forward. But to be very honest, it's nothing you can really plan from day to day. It's always looking at the big picture then.
Yeah. Do you have any specific... I mean, the feedback is very easy to understand and a very important part, obviously. Are there any objective metrics or points of data that you consider important, or is it more just looking at everything and combining it into the big picture?
I think I do work with this matrix. The data's coming from the lab, data coming from the field, and the feedback of the athletes. And those three things, they have to correlate. Not like every day and in every session, but for several sessions, just one feedback of those three is wrong. I have to go deeper into it and just make sure that it really correlates. So this is always a signal for me if this matrix is not working anymore. I have to be more specific and pay much more time within to one topic with them.
Yeah. And the other follow-up on the pro training that you described, you talked about finding the limiters of the different systems that you're working with. And you mentioned the cardiovascular system or muscular system. So can you talk a bit more about what is your approach for doing that? Is it very lab-based, or do you also include field data and field testing or just the general workout? Yeah, how do you find the limiters?
Yeah, I mean, the limiter is a mix of the data we are coming out of the lab, but we'll probably talk about that later a little bit. So we have very proper data. But then again, I mean, I have to look how the data is looking from the field. And those are common data like power, HR, and heart rate. We're doing, of course, resting heart rate, HRV data, one-to-one feedback of the athletes, very, very important for me. This is probably more or less on the cardiovascular side. Sometimes we're using MOXIE as well. And from when it comes more to the muscular side of the athlete, which may could be a limited factor of them. I really like to work within a team approach. So talking to the physiotherapists or the muscles or to the directly feedback of the athlete, maybe talk to other people who are involved in the team. So, really build up the team around the pro and not just doing all by myself, because I think things getting more and more complicated and we have experts and I try to bring the best people around us into the team. And then it's really being connected with all those stakeholders.
Yeah. Do you have can you share an example, and you don't have to name any names if you don't want to, but where you have had a clear example of, okay, you find that an athlete has a specific limiter, and then how did you find that? And then what were the steps that you took to address that?
We could maybe take it as example within the strength. So I'm hired there a coach, a specific strength coach from the UK, and they just huge time of assessment and really worked out the weak parts of the athletes, so we could understand why maybe something then in biking or in running is not really working on the muscular side or also on the neuronal side as we thought it should be. And then we went into specific, we found first the reason, and then we went into specific drills for that, in specific movements, specific strengthening. And my job then is to understand how I can combine it in the whole weekly structure of the athlete. And from then on, we're just working in this team approach, getting the feedback of the athlete, combine it with the feedback of the strength coach, and just summarize it all on my side and going into the next weeks or in the next phases. This would be like typical example for that.
Great, yeah. And then going over to the amateur side of things, so you mentioned that the most important thing probably there is to find that consistency and the stress from taking into account the stress from other factors as well, other than just training and how that is one of the key things. How can you specifically discuss a little bit around how that load from having a job, having family and so on, how does it in practice impact how much amateurs are able to train, how hard they're able to train? Can you talk more specifically about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I do with my age group is I'm using I call it like a bottom-up approach, meaning on the age group side, they send me on a weekly basis, they send me a schedule with the maximum training capabilities. And then normally I have very detailed information how their weekly structure looks like, and they tell me if they have some time splits in the morning, lunchtime, evening. Sometimes I know very specific, let's say Monday, I have 1 hour over lunchtime. I'm staying in the city. So I know exactly what I can do and what I not can do. And since the recovery time is the limited factor and the most here have demanding jobs with 45 to 55 hours of work, I really have to balance carefully. With the training, their other commitments. So as an example, when they travel somewhere I normally know when their flight times are, where they're staying overnight, how the hotel facility looks like. So I want to be as specific as we can get. And then, of course, normally I'm not using 100% of the training capabilities. So my experience is that most of the age group athletes overestimate themselves. But I'll take this into account when it comes to planning. And I'm then trying just to work as consistent as possible and add the recovery days or the recovery weeks based around their family and business demands. And I think from my experience, this is just the best way with working with the age groupers. And then, to be honest, being very, very specific, going towards the A races and just focus on the steak and leave the vegetables on the table. So that's how I would describe it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you mentioned there one of the things that I was very curious about, whether you leave some of the time that they might say they have available unused, which, well, you say that you did. And that makes a lot of sense. Do you, when you ask for their schedules, does that schedule also include, you know, sleep time and time to eat and so on, so that you can know in advance that, okay, they're not sleeping 5 hours a night and they don't skip meals just to get in the hours of training that they want to be getting in?
Yeah, I mean, now you're really hitting the target, right? I mean, this is the big problem we're facing. I mean, I know normally I see it in the past. So when you look at the diary, to be honest, some of them, they track the sleep and some they don't. And I cannot really, I mean, I tell them, please add sleep, but just you have to face sometime reality. They don't want to even add this to the diary. But it also depends from athlete to athlete. But I wish I could also track also those kind of information, as you just mentioned, like food quality, food timing, and recovery, of course. But reality looks different, to be honest.
Yeah. What about, let's say you have somebody who is very busy with work and family, and they have 10 hours per week to train, perhaps, but they want to be doing half or full distance triathlons. How do you, discuss specifically around those long distances, what are some approaches that you take to coaching age groupers that are time crunched for long distance races?
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about long distance races, I look first always at the strength and weakness profile of the athlete. So what is important for the race and what he has already on board. And then, I'm just going through different phases. Normally, those are like four phases. It's nothing special. So we do a lot of first phase, do a lot of technique and technical skills and building the aerobic base. Second phase, I would work with him probably more on intensity. But to be honest, I mean, if we're talking about having a weekly volume of 8 to 10 weeks, I'm probably more careful with a lot of VO2 max sessions, a lot of high intensity, just because they are limited in recovery. So I'm very careful that. Then I will probably go very, very specific to the strength part, of course. So just build up some specific strength. Of course, this is not a strength training itself, but I would call it like a strength-oriented approach.
So you're talking, for example, low cadence work on the bike, hills on the run. Is that what you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Work with high torques and doing that. Normally, this is a very important thing. Talking about long distance, having this power, right? And it's exactly what you said. Working on those classical things, but being specific with the data and the sets, and then this is probably the biggest phase then for an age group athlete. And then the last set, I will probably spend much time on specific race pacing with some threshold sets, being very early and specific with race nutrition, being also very specific with material we're using, just make sure that they're comfortable and they're not using it for the first time at the race. And then just general saying, using the capacity we worked up in the last couple of weeks and months. And this was now very easy and briefly, but just focus on what is really important. And of course, this is now theory. So in reality, normally it looks different. We have to be a little bit more flexible. Things are rarely not going as planned. So sometimes we have to mix a little bit, but I will go through those main four phases for a age group athlete within 8 to 10 hours. But again, for me, very important, we have to look at the strength and weakness profile of the athlete.
Yeah. And do you like to get the strength and the weakness profile? We'll talk about this a bit later, but what would you like all of your age groupers to do, some lab testing, or can you get some of the most important things even with just field testing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, yeah, I like to have lab testings, of course. I mean, that's where we're working and that's where we're coming from. But to be honest, I mean, sometimes it's just not possible for what kind of reasons ever. So we have to use different ways to find the right zones. And I mean, I understand if people not want to spend money on that. So then we'll probably do some specific outdoor or indoor testings. I'm not such a big fan from FTP stuff and all those kind of testings. I will probably do a little bit a different approach, but the main problem is with all the approaches that we never see the metabolic profile of the athlete. And if we only have like 8 to 10 hours for an age group, I think the metabolic profile is one of the most important tools to work with. But if we don't have it, I would probably do, you mentioned, for a different approach. I mean, we can do outdoor testings, having a specific loop and see how we improve on powers and heart rate and times and numbers. But I would probably use a calculation from your heart rate segment. Give you an example on that, and it's working only with heart rate. So you take your maximum heart rate, so let's say 170, and you take your resting heart rate, 170. It doesn't matter if we talk about bike and run now. And then you subtract the maximum heart rate from, you subtract the resting heart rate from your maximum heart rate, and this gives the heart rate segment. And from there, you calculate your aerobic zones and your threshold zones. And I like this. If we cannot measure in the lab, I like this approach better than FTP test.
Yeah, heart rate reserve in English is the term.
Heart, I believe. Exactly.
We'll get back to the testing and so on a bit later in this interview. But for now, let's move on to discussing some specifics around the different disciplines. So can you share one or two key fundamentals of your training process within first swimming?
Mm-hmm. I mean, beside now the phases we are in, I probably also have to split now the pros and the age groupers a bit, to be fair. But with the pros, I mean, they normally swim 5 to 6 times a week. I do force them to swim also short medley sets just to learn the skills. If they don't have the skills, we learn it in the winter and the off season, just to be a complete swimmer. Then when it comes to intensity and duration is increasing, these also have the reason in maximal adaptation possible then later. I do look a lot at technique, efficiency, even when we're getting closer to the races. I mean, since they're swimming 5 to 6 Ks, there is always some easy short sets to focus on technique. I look always for 1-2 week sessions for the pro that they can swim within a stronger group, especially for the hard sessions. Group should be not too strong, of course, but just that they're a good challenged. And then normally we have always like one once a week, a longer set, maybe start in December, January, 400 meters, and then going up all the way up to 1K and do that several times, depending on the season. And probably the most important is, for me, it's important to start open water as soon as possible. Same for the age grouper. So just use very early in the season to use your wetsuit, learn to navigate, because, I mean, yeah, normally you don't race in the pool, and you have to learn those skills, and this is very important. And here in Switzerland, we have so many lakes, and normally we can start early May with the open water sets. So this is important for the pros. With the age groupers, if they can do like three sessions, I'm very happy. Reality is more like two sessions a week. And depending on their swim skills, a little bit more or less technique. But when they do technique, for me, it's important that they can swim in a group where they get feedback from somebody on deck. Just having a coach or a triathlon coach or a swim coach, and they can also give them feedback about what they're doing, because it's good if you give them the drills, but it's very difficult to get any feedback on those kind of drills. So I think this is very important also for them to swim once, or better, two times a week in a group. And then if possible, I would add one more specific set, especially on the needs of the athlete per week for the age groupers.
Yeah, that's perfect. And let's take the same kind of approach to your bike training principles.
For the bike principle, also, I mean, volume counts for me. So oxygen consumption is important. We do longer rides, like 4.5 hours, but always looking for quality also within the 5 hours. So we try to avoid the junk miles. When we do long ones and easy ones, we look at efficiency work, so always add some high cadence, low cadence work, single leg drills, short sprints, to basic endurance session, and just with the target to improve their power transfer and be more efficient when it comes later into the season. Since most of the athletes live here in Switzerland, we work in general a lot of uphill, and then transfer it later into flat or hilly areas within specific race zones. And one point is really important for me is that my athletes work on their downhill skills. So they have a good technique in races for cornering, for roundabouts, etc. So I think this is so important. I mean, I have a cycling background, but if you sometimes look how people handle their bikes in triathlon, it's really a nightmare. And it's easy to talk about aero, and aero, but yeah, you need those basic skills on the bike. And that's why I love to force them to do technique in the winter. So we do gravel, mountain biking, and same for the age group. We do a lot, we do a lot of VO2 sessions in the second phase, especially with the pros. But there I really love to work with a block approach. So we do normally a lot of VO2 max session in the winter time, and combine it with low intensity training, but the overall volume then is much lower, because it's such a big workload when they do VO2 sets, sometimes two sets a day. And then later in the year, getting closer to the races, we work a lot on specific pacing, 70.3 Ironman pacing within race position, within specific nutrition. That's what we do, or what I do with the pros and with the age groupers. Again, we mentioned that before, their limiter is the recovery, but also the volume. So I always like to find a solution where we combine bike rides with their way to work, or maybe with some family requests on the weekend. So if you have a good relationship and they tell you about family and job situation, you know what you can maybe implement in a smart way. So we have in the morning like a free lunch ride to your job, and in the evening back, and then you have 2 hours, and you can combine it with the way to work. We have two sets for the age groupers. Yes, if they have enough time to recover, if they have enough time for sleep and proper nutrition, as you mentioned earlier. And again, for them, even more important, looking closely to the strength and weakness profile on the bike. And then normally talking about the age group or long distance, it's all about being stable on fat oxidation and have good power data. So that's what important, what's the most important normally for the age groupers.
Yeah, that's there's a lot of great information there, and great advice. A couple of follow-up questions. Firstly, on the terrain you mentioned there in Switzerland, you have the opportunity to do a lot of good uphill and downhill work. When you then have pros that go, or age groupers that go and race maybe a flatter Ironman or 7.3 or something, how do you in Switzerland have a good opportunity to actually practice those kind of courses, or how would you train specifically for a course that is flat if the terrain is not available?
I would still prefer them a lot on uphill, and then just going within the last couple of weeks into flat areas. But I mean, to be honest, Switzerland not only have hills, huh? We also have like flat parts, but not maybe as much as in Sweden or in Portugal or Spain. But I mean, we have the flat parts, and we can ride them. So then, of course, we're using them, but always try to get the power in the mountains and then in the flat roads, just staying for maybe 2 or 3 weeks before the races coming up, or before they're traveling to the races. So I would still then focus much on uphill work.
And within that uphill work, how do you incorporate it in the training? Like, would you, for example, tell an athlete that, okay, you have a 4-hour ride today, just go out and ride in the mountains, uphill, downhill, without saying very specifically about power targets or what have you? Or would you be more specific that, yeah, go up the climbs in zone 3 or in zone 2 or wherever you want to do? How does that work for you?
Yeah, no, I try to be very specific on that. So I tell them how long and exactly the zones I want to see them in. Normally, again, with this correlation of power, heart rate, and also should combine with the feeling of the athlete. And I mean, Switzerland is not that big, to be honest. Sometimes if I know where they live, I tell them exactly which climbs I want them to see. So there's sometimes I can do that. Yeah. So I tell them exactly which way they have to drive. And sometimes they do it and sometimes not. But since I have a background in cycling, yeah, I know the climbs here. And so I tell them. I also know which climbs are good for early sessions uphill, and then maybe later on. And then you have to know, are the mountains open because of snow? They're still closed. So I try to be specific as possible, and the most of them appreciate. And if I know that they don't appreciate, I'm not going to tell them. Then they make their own decisions. But I'm normally very specific with target zones and duration of the climbs.
And is that when with the target zones, would it be a lot of, yeah, you know, keeping it aerobic in zone 2, for example? And if that is the case, is there a difference between when you coached your females versus your males? Because obviously the power is very different, and maybe for the females sometimes it's difficult to go to keep it strictly aerobic when the climbs are steep and so on. So can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I know what you're meaning. I mean, yeah, it's different with the men and the girls, but also here I think it all comes to the specific weak and strength and strength profile of the athletes. So my pro girls right now, they are very like strong bikers, so they have a lot of power. They have very strong on uphill biking, they have really big numbers they can push. And yeah, I mean, I'm really impressed seeing those numbers. So to be honest, for those girls, it's not a real big difference. But when you talk about the age group girls, then, of course, you have to adapt the zones. And again, then you see the weakness of their, maybe of their body composition, and then you have to adapt it, of course, and be even there more specific.
Yeah, yeah. Is there, do you think that sometimes, you mentioned as the limiter example, some work on strength. Do you see that sometimes the just the muscle mass can be a limiter for people in general, but maybe for the women in particular, to building power on the bike?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, yeah, especially we can see that from the muscle mass, and especially as you mentioned for the female athletes, and that's why I always really, I mean, for me, it's important to, very important to have a strength training. Of course, again, depending on the body composition, but strength training is so important for several reasons. One is building the fatigue resistance. As you mentioned, increasing the muscle mass, mainly for women, but sometimes also for male. Maybe they have a running background and you just see that they struggle with their strength on the bike. So we have to do that with strength training and not with endurance approach strength training. It's also important, but to make the difference, you have to work really focused on strength if it's a weak point. And then also just to improve basic athletes level and specific firing patterns. But again, individuality is very important. And what we do here is we check then the progress with DEXA scan, and we see exactly how the muscle mass or the lean body mass in the legs have improved. And also we're looking at muscular disbalances, left leg, right leg. Before you talk about pedal smoothness, you should go one step back and see, are the muscles in the legs build it up the same way? And if not, we're going to do it in the gym, right? And then we're doing the next step. So yeah, this is very important for me and the athletes.
And then the other follow-up question on biking, that was actually several already, but one more that I have is around the VO2 max intervals. Do you have a preference around what type of VO2 max work you give athletes? Because there are several different schools of thought on that, longer mm-hmm. intervals, shorter intervals with short rests, or fast start intervals, lots of different options. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Mm-hmm. Starting harder and then easy, and maybe a little bit easier. So there's so many interesting sets, but I really love to mix them. So start with shorter and higher numbers and then going a little bit longer. But again, it depends a little bit on where we're going. So let's take an example, the junior from the Swiss national team. I mean, they're like the really short and high sessions are important. And with other athletes, maybe also have a little bit of different body composition or muscle fiber types. I tend maybe also to do a little bit longer sets and not only the really short ones where they need so much time then to recover, and especially again the age group, but they just don't, then they struggle really to recover. They can't sleep the whole night, so it makes no sense then just to do those very, very intensive VO2 sessions. So I'm careful.
And what does long mean here when we talk about long? Is it 3 minutes or 6 minutes or what are we talking about?
No, up to 4 minutes.
Then running, if you can share your principles around running.
Well, in running, even for the pros, I'm careful with volume and intensity. Again, I mean, it depends on the running skills of the athlete, but I think quality is more important than quantity. So I do look a lot for motoric skills, running technique, and a good of running economy. So we do a lot of one-to-one coaching, video exchanging videos, and just looking for small things such as cadence, vertical oscillation, stability, etc. And in the target, in the end, the target is just to be save energy and be more efficient on the long distance races. So we do a lot. Beside that, we do a lot again of uphill run, and then also do trail runs a lot, just to reduce the impact on the structure side. Saying that, building the volume up carefully, maybe start with double runs before we do long runs. But to be honest, long runs are never longer than 2 hours, maybe 2:10-ish, but never longer than that. And even if we do like a long run, we'll probably also just make a few stops and maybe add 1 or 2 minute drills and just make sure that we are at a very good technical level when they restart. Track sets, to be honest, not so much. I love to have them short and fast, but not too much, just because of, again, injury cases. And I like to add a lot of barefoot running on grass to strengthen the foot and get a direct feeling for the ground contact, and then going on the track and do, or onto the road and do the fast stuff. But again, we're not doing that many track sessions, and with the pros. And then for the age group, it's even worse, talking about the injuries coming from running. So again, I would say just as much as needed, focus on what is important, efficiency. Be very careful with super fast sessions on the track. Prefer also to have them running uphill, then transfer it into flat or hilly areas. And for the age group, it's also just learn them to run controlled with different speed. And this is important, just to stay within a controlled zone and not just humbling them with the technique. And then, we see the damage after a few weeks and start again. By zero.
Hmm. On the volume for your pros, for example, what would be a typical weekly running volume?
Like a typical one, maybe 55 to 65 k's a week. So this is not very much. But to be honest, I have one athlete, he has an excellent running technique, and he's very light and very stable. So then we also facing maybe 2 weeks where we're going close to 90, maybe also 100K, but this is then really exceptional. So we're not doing that very often. Just be, again, very careful on the volume side.
Yeah. And then in terms of the faster work, the quality sessions, if you want to call it that, it sounded like, can you correct me if I'm wrong, you do some maybe some fast stuff and then build up to short and fast intervals, but do you do a lot of like threshold work or tempo work, or not so much?
Yes, more like, I mean, in this second phase, as we mentioned, where we focus a lot on VO2, building up the breathing patterns and all that, we're doing a lot of short and fast stuff, but then probably we're doing more on the treadmill to have a safe environment. And then later, as you mentioned, more around threshold, also on different grounds, and not always on the track with the same angle. So just, again, I'm careful with that. I mean, those guys are triathletes and not pure runners. So I want to try to avoid the injuries, and there are other possibilities to make them first in running, I think. But the short sessions, sometimes we do them on the track. Yeah, the really short ones.
What's your take on the general crossover effect, like how the general fitness of swimming and biking can help any athlete with also being better at running? I mean, obviously there is a crossover effect, but do you think that it's a very strong one, or kind of moderate or small? What's your take on that?
It's a good question. The answer would be probably it depends on. I think there is a crossover effect, and if you have a kind of a body composition who fits more to a runner, you benefit more from the crossover. And if you if you don't have that, if you just struggle a lot with economics in running and technique, you're probably not going to join this crossover effect. So that's as the other guys. So that's what my impression is and what I get from as a feedback from the athletes.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then let's discuss strength training. You mentioned that you do use it and consider it very important. Can you talk some specifics around how you implement it?
Yeah, I mean, normally, to be honest, we're using it more or less over the whole season, but we, again, depends on the strength and weakness profile of the athletes. We do work also through different phases, and as closer as we get, the more we start to reuse the volume of the strength training. But if somebody is really, really struggling, let's say, with muscular disbalances or with strength female athletes, we would stay for very long during those phases until very close to the race with specific strength training.
Yeah. And anything in particular that you do you have any preference in terms of the weight versus rep kind of ratios that you're using, or do you periodize that and build from something to something? Can you discuss that a bit?
Yeah, we do it, as you mentioned, we're going to build it up from one point to another one. And then, I mean, it's not the idea that they increasing muscle mass. The aim is that they increasing power. So it always comes down to the point. I mean, if possible, we're going to check again with DEXA and see how our body composition reacts. But then it comes to the point where we have to make sure that the muscles can transfer it to the pedal or to the ground. So then, yeah, I really have to focus on that their muscles are firing and that we can transfer it, and it's not the target that they're increasing their muscle mass. And there, of course, it also, again, it depends on the muscle fiber type. So we have to learn how the athlete reacts on different strength stimulus. And, I mean, this is still, to be honest, this is still a big question mark to understand what is the right stimulus for the different kind of athletes in reality, combined with a lot of endurance training. So this is still a huge challenge for coaches, at least for me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And when the target is really to get that power to transfer, of course, to, as you said, to the bike or to the run or the swim, then does exercise selection become very critical for you? Like, for example, do you work with a lot of unilateral exercises, which might be more specific to the movement patterns of running and cycling, or do you think that, well, it doesn't have to be that specific, you can still get the transfer in other ways?
No, well, absolutely agree on your point. Try to be then as specific as possible. Yeah, absolutely. And right. I would also love to work in the future, I'm not too deep into it, but with ENG measurement, just also to see nerve conductions. I think this is very interesting when it comes to the transfer. But still so much to do, so many interesting things. And it's so fascinating then to understand how everything fits together and how we can transfer the power into, as you mentioned, into the from the muscles to the ground or to the pedal.
Yeah. Moving on to the next topic and question, which is around how to put everything together into a program. Can you discuss how you balance load and recovery and how you balance volume and intensity? Just some general principles for the overall program, the holistic aspects of how you put things together.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned that before. For the age group, is just try to be as consistent as possible, based on their possibilities with family and all that. And sometimes we do very classical approach, like staying 3 weeks, or improving maybe a little bit on the volume, depending on the different phase. But again, not having huge yo-yo effects, and then maybe doing an easier week, but also they're not going too deep in terms of volume, but just take off intensity. But again, here it's just so important to know what's coming up in their business, in their job. If they have to travel, then maybe I would also not be very classic in 3 weeks workload and then 1 week off. I just try to combine that with what's going around their lives. And also, of course, tracking very, very carefully their recovery, or at least that they give me a feedback so I can build up the system around them. So I'm normally not using a standardized approach, because everybody is so different with their needs and their possibilities within the age group. And for the pros, maybe some people are surprised, but yeah, they do easy days. They do even rest days. I think it's important that they have that. And normally it's not planned in advance. It's the same thing we talked before. If I see that they're getting too tired, that the feedback is not the one I want to see anymore, it's not that good as I want to see it, or if, let's say, the heart rate ratio to the power ratio is not right anymore, then we'll bring up an easy day or even a rest day. So this is nothing bad, and it's an important part of even of the pro approach to have easy days. When we are in huge blocks, normally I'm doing like every third or fourth days an easy day, and sometimes we're just staying for 7 to 10 days, 10 days on a certain volume. So it's really different from athlete to athlete.
And what about the balance between volume and intensity? Do you have any sort of pattern that when, well, I guess it depends on the period, so you can elaborate on how you see fit.
Yeah, very much on those periods. Again, in this call it phase two or whatever, how we want to name it, there is so much intensity, or so much, there is a lot of intensity. As I said, maybe two times a day, like VO2 sets. So there we have high numbers of intensity and maybe low numbers of volume. And then we're going to skip that again and going to build it up from the other side. So there is really not the general numbers I can yeah. give you on
yeah.
that.
No, that's fine. Yeah. The 2 a day VO2, that's a curious one. Where does that come from? Is it something that you've come up with, or does it come from your cycling background, or have you seen research on it?
Yeah, both. We've done that in cycling, of course, a lot. And I, of course, would not do that with age grouper, to be honest. So please don't do that as an age grouper. But with the pros, yeah, we have seen good improvements, having like 2 VO2 sets per day, let's say over 2 to 3 days, and then maybe have another just very easy sessions between. And athletes, you want to improve the breathing patterns and the VO2 max. We see quite good improvement there, but again, you have to be very careful with that and be in close contact with the athletes in terms of recovery. Nutrition has to be excellent, and there should be no other impacts for the athletes. So he really can do that in a focused environment. But yeah, in cycling, this is nothing new there. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah. And when you do it with your pros, is it 2 a day of the same discipline, like 2 a day cycling VO2, or is it like a swim VO2 and then a bike VO2?
It can be both. It can be both. Depends on where we want to put our targets on.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But of course, we would never do like two running VO2 sets per day. Of course, this is a no-go. Yeah.
Let's discuss testing and diagnostics. So, and this is again maybe something where you can discuss pros and amateurs separately if you want to. First of all, what are the things that you have mentioned them already? But a testing battery that you would do for maybe a pro athlete that starts working with you, for example, when you want to know, like you want to have as much information as possible, what would the testing battery be?
Testing battery, I mean, beside the talking and the analyzing the data and the past and all that, just in the lab we would do, like, typically we do DEXA scan for body composition, we do VO2 max, so spiroergometry testing, maybe a ramp testing for specific VO2 max, and classical testing, or even just a how we call it, like endurance testing. So we're only looking at the data up to threshold and going not above, but have a different protocol just to be very specific on the low numbers and see how the data is looking like. And we would normally use, like, for that, like spiroergometry, lactate, MOXIE, as I said, MOXIE for isolates the muscle layer to measure SMO2 in real time. We do test them all on a Cyclos 2 as an ergometer, so that one is extremely accurate. So the pros, but even the age grouper, can test on their own bikes. And since the most of them have power meters, we look at the delta of the power meters. And it's very funny. In reality, we see that the most power meters are just not accurate for what kind of reasons ever. But then you give the athletes, of course, training zones in power numbers and in heart rate numbers, which are correct coming from a Cyclos 2, which is a validated Cyclos. And then they have like 10 or 20% delta on their power meter. So they have complete wrong numbers when they go into execution. So we're always looking at the power meter and give them a protocol of the delta. If there is one, is it progressive? Is it degressive, or is it steady? And then maybe the most important, but we should just do HEC measurement. I mean, this is so important to prevent irregularities to react at an early stage when something is conspicuous. So I think in a good lab, you can combine it as always with spiroergometry. And then we also see that the whole heart things are in a good way. This is just so important if you work with athletes.
Mm, yeah, yeah. And what about if you have an age grouper, let's say somebody who is local in Zurich that can come into your lab, and would you do all the same tests with them if they have the, well, they are local and they have the funds to do the testing? Would all the same things make sense for an age grouper as well?
I mean, there is nothing, it would make no sense, but, you know, saying maybe the MOXIE data, we use MOXIE data just to confirm the data we have from spiroergometry, so maybe you leave the MOXIE beside, but the rest from the setup is pretty similar as we're using for the pros, so there is not a big difference in that. Mm. Yeah.
What about testing in the different disciplines? So that there you described the bike testing, but would you also want to do some treadmill testing for the run, or even swim testing? How do you view, if not, how do you transfer some of the information to the other disciplines?
Mm-hmm. Bike and running, as you mentioned, probably this is something you can kind of combine it if, and I think this is important, if the athlete does not have a specific background within running or biking. So then you can kind of estimate the numbers from a bike test to the run data. But you have to be a little bit careful with that. But if it's the case to save some money, I think you can do that. I mean, we have done that before, and sometimes people asking that. But yeah, it really then comes to the athlete's profile to be specific and tell him, well, okay, maybe in terms of heart rate, we're going to add for running 3 to 4 beats per minute or 10 beats or whatever. But yeah, probably you can do that. You can do that.
Yeah. And
if you have some experience with it.
And what about swimming? That's much more difficult to test, obviously. How do you tackle that?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. So swimming is very different. So from the other tests, do just classical CSS testing. And but beside that, I love, especially with the pros, also to see how they improve over short distance, like 50 meters and 100 meters with several repeats. And then also on the longer ones over 60 and 800. That's what I love to add on the swimming side, besides just doing the standardized CSS protocol.
Yeah, I personally, just give my personal opinion on the CSS test, I used that for a long time, but I have stopped that some time ago because I think the 200 and 400 meter distances, they are so close to each other that it's as if you do a critical power test on the bike and you use, let's say, 3 minutes and 5 minutes or something, and or 2.5 and 5 minutes, but you would rather use 2 minutes and 15 minutes or 2 minutes and 12 minutes. So I started using 100 and 1000 for my swim testing, and I find that that is much better for giving more of a strengths and weaknesses profile of the athlete as well.
100% agree. And I mean, we always have to keep in mind that proper testing just needs, I mean, it needs time to prepare, right? We have to take off time, and it has to be specific and all that. And we also can talk about testing with the lactate on the pool, but I mean, handling the lactate is not that easy if you want to have really proper data. You have to look at so many things, and I'm not sure if it's really an add value if you're then using the lactate on the pool side, if not everything around you talk about nutrition, talking about the offload before and all that is really 100% standardized, clean. So you probably better work with just, heart rate data.
Yeah. And what about, are there any common mistakes that you see in testing that should be avoided? Like, for example, I mean, this is, we don't need to beat around the bush with the fact that different labs do things differently, and not all labs are the same quality and have the same precision in their protocols. And I've seen many, many tests from athletes where it's clear that the lab has done a poor job with how they have conducted the test. Are there any common mistakes that you would recommend athletes, if we have listeners, for example, that are interested in going into a local lab and doing a test, they should look out for and things to avoid?
It's a super question, really. You know what I would say? A lot of athletes, they have complete wrong expectation for outcoming data. I mean, since so many data are available on internet, on social media, but it's exactly the point what you mentioned, but you cannot really look at the quality and this design of those data and the testing. So I think it's really important, we do explain the process and the test design and the tools we're using to the client or to the athlete. So I think this is what you have to understand. And then maybe you're using a method which is different from another lab, but you understand the difference And then you also understand maybe the different data. Does this make sense? Maybe I can give an example on, let's talk about body composition, fat percentage. If you go on the internet or listen to podcasts or whatever, people talk about, those Tour de France athletes or triathletes, they're having 3 to 4% body fat. But in reality, this is not possible. This is not true. I mean, you're not alive anymore with 2% body fat. So having like 7 to 8% body fat is an extremely low number. So the question is, what kind of tool you're using for those kind of data? If you're working with DEXA and you have visceral fat and subcutaneous fat, I mean, the right numbers, 7%, 8% is extremely low. But at a Tour de France or in training camp, you cannot take your DEXA with you. So you're probably using Caliper, right? And then with Caliper, you see much lower numbers. So people start to mix that up and talking about they expect having low numbers, but then they're facing numbers from a different testing quality. And they getting completely confused. So I think it's important to learn to understand what's the testing design and the quality behind the testing. And I mean, Caliper is nothing bad. You also can see a trend, positive or negative, with the Caliper, but data are not 100% correct. So I think there's something you have to understand when it comes to testing and avoid wrong expectation.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I've definitely seen that, like, what are the expectations around, for example, what your VO2 max should be, I think is, FTP is a common one as well. And that's what I think why some tests have been developed that kind of get your FTP higher and higher and you can choose your highest number. But VO2 yeah. max, I think, suffer from the yeah. same thing, that people have expectations that, yeah, if you're an upper mid-pack male triathlete, you should have a VO2 max of 60, which is absolutely not the case. But that's the expectation that athletes have. And then they can be surprised when they go and do a quality test with good equipment and it's not what they thought it would be.
Yeah, and as you said, I mean, we could do like in the lab a ramp test, and you have probably different VO2 when you want to do just a standardized test where you want to have threshold and proper fat oxidation data, metabolic profile. You also will face different numbers. So it's a question, what do you want for the fund you're going to spend, right? So what is really the need of those kind of data you're looking for?
Yeah. We talked already about how you can use the testing to understand the athlete's strengths and weaknesses and their limiters and so on. But beyond that, are there any other things that you want to mention about how to apply the results from testing in the athlete's training? For example, would you rely quite strictly on training zones that you set there and training targets? And are there any other things you want to mention about the application of testing in training?
First, I think if in general, just if you're testing, I mean, you need to be using the information to have an influence or an impact on your training. I think there is really no point on just doing it to test for social media or because other athletes doing it. So I think this is the main target. Then I think to be honest, I mean, the more inexperienced the athlete is, the more he can benefit from a proper testing. So normally, I mean, I would recommend now to do a testing for an inexperienced athlete after 2 to 4 weeks after he starts the season. And then maybe if, as you mentioned, he has the fund, just doing it maybe 3 months, 4 months later, but at least some weeks before the race, so he still can do some adaptation, but he can also use the data for the pacing, at least on the bike, if you have a proper metabolic profile. And it should have a consequence on what you're doing in the future. And I think it helps you to plan the next steps and see also if your plan is working. And for me as a coach, it also helps to try or to explain the athletes why, or I should say it different. I try to explain to my athletes why and when I want to test, so they understand the reasons and the targets for it, not just because, not just testing because I want to test. I'm going to explain them so they feel comfortable with that. And I mean, yeah, with the core, with the pro, we have different possibilities. So there, we test at several points in the season and gain information about the process is going on. Are we looking at specific targets? You mentioned VO2 max. We want to see if it's really adapting. So saying that, just summarizing, I think several testings a year are useful, but for an age group, it's really not the main thing. But very honestly, I mean, but sometimes testing can be for age group more useful than investing in expensive equipment, especially if they are not that familiar with their training zones or they don't have this developed body feeling. So I think it can really make more sense than expensive equipment. And from the coaching point of view, it can also help to explain why performance at the race wasn't as expected, especially when the athletes then are disappointed with their performance or have before the race just unrealistic expectation, right? So it helps also just to show them why, from a coaching point of view, it's not possible that he's riding a 4:45 on 180Ks. I think this is also a good help on this side.
Yeah. A few fun questions to finish off with. First, what is something that you've changed your mind about in training or in coaching in the last few years and that you now perhaps think differently about or do differently?
That's it. Yeah, I think I do pay much more attention when it comes to details about execution. When I started coaching with age groupers, I mainly cared about the planning and the analyzing. So I thought creating a valuable plan was my job or my task. And today, I really understand that when it comes to work with the pro, but also with the age group, the planning and the analyzing is probably the smallest part of my job. And I do regularly exchange with some coaching friends, also coaching pros. And one of them told me, before I started with the pros, he told me that when I understand the difference between writing a training plan and coaching, then you're really ready for the pros. And I think I understand that now. But being a little bit more specific on your questions, I do question a lot more about tools and gadgets that are on the market for so-called performance enhancement or measurements, especially when it comes to reliability. So at the beginning, when I was new in the coaching business, I thought, well, this could secure, you know, my work kind of. And today I'm a little bit disillusionated about the quality of those tools that are sometimes integrated into training. So normally the athletes coming up and they want to add this and that. And just to be very honest, I would say less would often be more than just using all the gadgets that are on the market. And when you understand what's behind it and you see that data are not really accurate, it's a waste of time and money in the end.
Yeah, 100%. And is there any currently popular training fallacy that you would like to maybe just bring a different perspective to or correct, if you will?
Maybe it's not really a training fallacy, but I do have the impression that on middle and especially on long distance triathlon within the last years, a lot of athletes think that intensity is more important than a certain volume. Partially the high intensity training is the holy grail. And for me, this looks different. So for me, volume is and remains important. And of course, we need intensity. We talked about that before. We do intensity. It's important. But I think like a solid base of endurance and aerobic work is still the foundation of long-distance triathlons, and there are no shortcuts for that.
Yeah. What about if you mentioned you coached a junior Swiss athlete training for short distance? Then is your answer different, or what, do you view volume differently in that context?
Absolutely, absolutely. No, I'm really talking about middle and long distance. Short distance, completely different approach, of course. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. If you could give three pieces of advice for listeners that would help them improve their triathlon or endurance performance, what would that be?
I would probably learn to listen to the feedback of your body and work together with your body and not against him. And yeah, use those data for recovery, such as resting heart rate, HRV, calculate time to recover, and don't try to cut off the time there. So I think this is an important piece. Another one about the nutrition in general, take it very seriously, meaning before, during, and after training. And start with training, start to implement race nutrition as soon as possible. Don't wait until the last week, and learn to consume high number of carbs for the races. This is a real game changer, and that's something you have to train and to learn. And it's not enough if you start 2 weeks before before your competition. And the last one would probably, especially for long distance, just focus on efficiency wherever you can. It's all about being efficient as possible.
Perfect. Yeah, great tips. And now let's do the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to triathlon or endurance sports?
Favorite one, not a favorite one, but the one I'm working or reading right now, it's a French one called Puissance et Performance en Cyclisme. It's from the chief of performance of the Groupama FDJ pro cycling team. That's the one I'm looking at it right now. And just to mention another thing, it's not a book, but I like the content from Jasker Jorkendrup and the look and feel how he's presenting the stuff. I like that very much, but it's not a book to read.
Yeah, well, it's a resource, book or resource.
yeah,
so it fits. Yeah, agreed. What's the name of the author of that, the Groupama FDJ?
It's Frederik Krapp.
And what's an important habit that you have benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Just be patient and reliable, and then I think hard work will pay off.
And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
To be honest, it's no one in particular, but I really and honestly, I do have big respect in coaching from people who work really hard in the background and don't push themselves into the spotlight, especially even if they are successful. So I think the achievements of the athlete always belong to the athlete himself. And as a coach, I think you have to accept that you're in second or third row. And I'm looking up to those coaches who handle that very well.
Yeah, yeah. And just to finish off, where can people find out more about you and your business, website, social media, and so on?
We have a homepage, traininganddiagnostic.ch. We have an Instagram channel called Training and Diagnostics. I have an Instagram channel by myself, Reto Brandley, but to be honest, I'm not doing that that intense. I'm living more in the real world and probably also not that good on it. But I do publish some things there about the athletes, never about my family or about my personal life. It's just about the business. But in general, just follow my athletes, pro athletes, they will appreciate, and they publish everything on their channel, what is really important.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you so much, Rizzo. It's been great to chat to you. Lots of really good, interesting information. I appreciate it a lot, and I'm sure that the listeners will enjoy. So hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Michael. It was really a pleasure and an honor to be on your channel.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with links to the training and diagnostics website and Instagram. Also, we mentioned blood flow restriction training. The latest episode I did on that was with Dr. Richard Ferguson in episode 270, so I'll link to that as well if you're interested in learning more. And I found the book by Frédéric Grapp on Amazon, the French book about cycling performance, so I have linked to that as well. If you want to take your triathlon performance to the next level or achieve whatever goals you might have in triathlon or endurance sports, then one of the best things you can do, if not the best thing, is to work with a coach. Check out our coaching options on scientifictriathlon.com on the coaching page. Or if coaching is not an option for you, then you can always consider working with a ready-made training plan. We have some really high quality ready-made training plans that you can consider as well. You can read more on the website, or you can always email me and we can discuss your specific goals and needs and see what's best for you. Next Monday on the podcast, I talk to Dr. Danielle Munith about heart rate decoupling and how it might relate to performance and durability characteristics in endurance athletes. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free online sweat test and quick carb calculator to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs. And book a free video consultation with the team at PH to refine your hydration and nutrition strategy. Remember their new caffeine gel, the PF30 caffeine drops today. Use the code TTS22 at checkout for 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products. And thank you to Senate. Use the Senate Swim Trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and your swim training consistency. Get 20% off your order of the Swim Trainer with the promo code that you can get on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. And don't forget that it's a risk-free investment. If you don't love it after 2 weeks, send it back and you'll get a full refund. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.